Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do scientists ponder the mysteries of the universe and arrive at conclusions that change the world? For those of us working in other professions, it is tempting to conceive of scientists as possessing almost magical abilities to comprehend what wasn't understood before, like gravity, electromagnetic fields, and the relationship between time and space. But despite our romantic visions, conceptual innovations almost never spring fully formed into the minds of scientific pioneers. Instead, they often employ something called model-based reasoning to mull over problems, and nearly always rely on a body of work done by those who have come before. Nancy J. Nersessian has made a career out of trying to understand how the process works. She's a professor of cognitive science at Georgia Institute of Technology and the author of a book called Creating Scientific Concepts. Her lecture tonight at 7:30 is entitled How Do Scientists Think? Creative Process in Conceptual Innovation. The talk takes place at the UTD campus as part of the ongoing lecture series Creativity in a Technological Era. Nancy, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me here. I appreciate the invitation.
So your work has shown that scientific thinking is in many ways just sort of an extension, a steroidal extension perhaps, of mundane cognition. How do scientists elevate everyday thinking into what they need for their work?
Right. So what I've argued is that the kinds of processes that scientists draw on, for example, like analogies, imagery, thought experimentation, which then becomes sort of mental simulation, is very similar to the kinds of things that we do. So, for example, when you want to get a sofa through a door, you sit there and you look at it and you don't, you know, get out your measuring rod, you know, until you get to the final part of that. Maybe if you haven't been able to figure out in your mind, what you do is you sort of flip something around in your mind that's something sort of sofa-like and you figure out the angles and you get it through the door. So what I'm saying is that scientists are actually doing the same sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But how they get to what you're calling the steroids is that they are what psychologists call metacognition, metacognitively aware. That is, they reflect on and refine and think about the processes as they're using them. So if they're using an analogy, for example, they're not just making an analogy, and trying to use it. They're thinking about how does analogy work? Hmm. So how might I use these particular processes in order to extrapolate from the analogy new things that I might not be able to get if I weren't actually thinking about the nature of the process itself.
So they literally are thinking about the thinking.
They're thinking about their thinking, yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that's what makes for the difference. So it's not that, I would say there are geniuses, but it's not that geniuses think in a whole different way from the way that we do. In fact, my research and a lot of other research, I think, shows that the more you study these geniuses, the more you realize that they're drawing on the ordinary capacities, but they're in a social cultural context that requires that they think about what they're doing and reflect on it.
What's really interesting about this is there is, it seems, a connection between artistic creative thinking, in that many times artists will tell you that they've been working on something and then they have to step back and do something entirely different for a while, mm-hmm. and that sort of frees them up. And that's not exactly the same as thinking about the process, perhaps, mm-hmm. but there is that sort of distance.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think scientists do that too. So one of the things that is interesting about the case of James Clerk Maxwell, mm-hmm. who's the person who developed the field equations, the mathematics for the electromagnetic field, which then made possible things like relativity and quantum mechanics and all those, you know, groovy things that we think about now. At various points in what he was working on, he actually did stop working. He'd say, okay, I can't figure this out. And so therefore, I'll just publish what I've got now. And then, you know, 8 months later, he publishes another part and another piece and another piece. So you see the same kind of thing there. But also these kind of modeling practices that I'm talking about, you see them being used in the arts and sciences equally, I think.
And there are certainly little aha moments along the way, but they tend to be more common than the giant eureka moment that we imagine taking mm-hmm. place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the eureka moment, I think, really can't happen unless you have the quote-unquote prepared mind. That is, so there are all these tales, you know, Kekule's falling asleep in front of the fireplace and he sees a snake biting its tail and then he comes up with the benzene ring. Or Poincaré steps onto a bus and suddenly all the equations come into his head. But these people have been wrestling with these problems for a very, very long time. And so when this sudden flash comes to them, that's eureka moment, which I think it does happen. It comes at the moment when they've been thinking about it for a long time, and maybe at that point they're having a down moment. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's the same thing. I remember when I was in school and I used to solve logic problems because I was taking a course in logic. And I would go to sleep at night and I wake up in the morning and I was able to solve that problem that I couldn't solve before. So it's a similar kind of thing.
Nancy, are scientists taught to think this way when they're in undergraduate, education?
Yeah, now that's an interesting one. Not usually. Okay, so that's part of the problem. I think part of the reason why we aren't as successful with undergraduate education as we could be is that we have not been pulling these kinds of qualitative modeling processes into educating students. And that's part of the other part of my research is actually to try and think about ways of creating these environments where students can become, you know, these sort of reflective learners in the process of doing science. What happens, and I think, so you say, okay, well, we are successful. We produce some people, right? So we do produce some people that seem to pick up some of it on their own.
Just naturally.
They pick it up naturally, and then some of those would go on. And when they go on, what happens, there's a shift in graduate school. When you're in graduate school, you have an apprenticeship, basically, what we call a cognitive apprenticeship, where you are watching and observing the practice while you're participating in the practice. And so you see what's going on there, and you then adopt that as your ways of being. But what I'm saying is that I think that we should introduce that earlier on. One article I wrote was, should physicists preach what they practice? Mm-hmm. And my answer, of course, is yes. So if we get the freshman student and we introduce them to these ways of thinking, we're more likely to be successful. And actually, there have been some studies that shows that we are more successful when we do that.
It also sounds as if you'd get more people interested in science who somehow have not yet made that leap into doing it. They can study it, but they don't really feel it's part of them.
Yeah, and they also feel that it's, you know, just all this equation matching. And mm-hmm. so therefore, you know, I'm not good at math, I'm not good at equations, so therefore I don't do it. So I was telling a story at dinner last night, which is a very personal one, which I think sometimes my research came completely out of this. I was passionate about physics. I love physics. This is when I was young, whatever, you know, this idea. I heard about relativity and I started getting excited about all of this stuff. And when I got to college and became a physics major, I started hating physics. And I hated physics because of the way they taught it. They taught it as this dry, sterile subject. And I wanted to know, what does it have to do with the world, you know, and the excitement. And so I went and took a class in philosophy. And in philosophy, I had the fortune, it was an introductory to philosophy class, but it was taught by a famous philosopher of space and time. So everybody else in the class hated it. I loved it. And then I said, yes, because he's wondering about how this stuff maps onto the universe, not just how to calculate where the cannonball lies. And so that's why I actually went off and did my PhD in philosophy instead of physics. But when I started reading the works of physicists themselves, Einstein, Maxwell, Newton, Faraday, they're exciting. They are excited by their problems. And if I had known that's what physics was, I probably would have stayed.
Is it possible to study this kind of innovation in real time as it's happening, or do you have to go back and read the works of Newton and Einstein and try to piece together after the fact how it went down?
Well, funny you should ask that. Okay. So, but the part of the work that I've done in the past, say before we're starting about 8 years ago, has been looking at these historical cases. Because for one thing that's important, you know that something important happened. And so the question is, you know, if you're studying it live, maybe you're not going to get to anything that's important. But then I began to realize that particularly if you want to start thinking about how the social and cultural context also fits with these cognitive practices and how they're developed and used online, you actually have to start looking at the scientists. So I learned ethnography, and I am actually, along with my co-PI, Wendy Neustadter, we've been looking at four laboratories, research laboratories, in the bioengineering, biomedical sciences, from tissue engineering, neural engineering, integrative systems biology. And these laboratories are populated by graduate students. All university research laboratories are. So they're great sources to look at learning, too, how people develop these practices, but also how they learn them. And they're all sort of on the frontiers of science. These people are pushing the boundaries and trying to do things. I mean, they're trying to, like, you know, create learning in a dish of brains, of neurons, and to get it to drive robotic arms and things like that, you know. So they're really pushing the frontiers. And so it has been very exciting for the past 8 years to be studying these. And I've been seeing creative practices and processes in the making. And in a couple of cases have caught some really what stand to might potentially be historically creative innovations. So yeah, you can do it that way too.
Nancy J. Nersessian is my guest. She's professor of cognitive science at Georgia Institute of Technology and the author of a book called Creating Scientific Concepts. She's in town to speak tonight at UT Dallas at 7:30 as part of the Creativity in a Technological Era lecture series. Her talk is called How Do Scientists Think? Creative Process in Conceptual Innovation. Join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Jeff Whittington has just popped into the studio. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. And hello to you if you're listening right now, and obviously you are listening right now. This is your opportunity to support Think, support KERA, and it's really crucial that you do it right now at 888-694-6931. Why? Because there's a challenge on the table from Julia Pendery. We have to get 100 donations by 2 o'clock today. 100 donations at any amount, and Julia will give the station an additional $2,500. This is at risk. If we don't hear from 100 people with a contribution to any amount, $5, $500, whatever it is, by 2 o'clock, we don't get to accept $2,500.
We would hate to walk away from that amount of money, and we know that you would hate for us to have to walk away from it. So give us a call now at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. You know, Jeff, this is our first challenge grant during Think for this entire drive. So for those of you who have been waiting for a challenge grant, now is the time.
Yeah, this is your opportunity to really make a difference for the station so that we can accept this additional gift of $2,500, but also so that we can get a little bit farther today so that we can wrap this drive up hopefully by the end of the day tomorrow. I've been talking all day today. I was here early this morning talking about how
I woke up to the sound of your voice, you and Ann Bothell.
We don't really want to be fundraising this weekend. We'll do it if we have to, but we don't want to do it, and you don't want us to do it, so make your contribution right now, 1-888-694-6931. Go online to kera.org. And again, any contribution to any level, an additional gift of $5 or $10 counts as a contribution, but we must receive 100 contributions by 2 o'clock. We're going to count down, and hopefully we'll get some here quickly, or we have to say thanks but no thanks to a $2,500 challenge from Julia Pendery.
I believe this is one of the biggest challenge grants we've had during this show as well, which is something to keep in mind. You know, a couple of weeks ago, Jeff, we did this show on procrastination, and we've had a lot of email from people who got around to telling us
That's
that
right.
they were interested in the show. If that show was of interest to you, but maybe you've procrastinated in renewing your membership or signing up for one the first time, make this the day that you take action, because it really does matter. I can't stress to you enough how much money $2,500 is to a not-for-profit public radio station. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it's really important that we achieve this challenge, that we win this challenge from Julia Pendery, because the station really does really can use those additional funds. Use them very wisely to continue to bring you conversations like this one, all the conversations we've had on Think this week, and all of the programming that you get from National Public Radio, Public Radio International. But you've got a call to do your part, 1-888-694-6931. Again, the number is 1-888-694-6931, or do it online at kera.org. We just have about an hour and 40 minutes, Chris, to make this challenge. We've got to get 100 contributions before 2 p.m. In order to achieve this challenge.
Here's the great news, though. If you're signing up for your regular membership level, maybe that's, you know, $50 or $100 or $300, you can certainly call with that. If you've already made a contribution and you want to make an additional gift to help us to earn this challenge, you can make just a gift of a few dollars, and it will count toward the goal of 100 calls during membership calls during Think.
Yeah, it can be an additional gift of any amount or any size. Doesn't even have to be an official membership donation, just an additional gift or a donation that counts toward the overall goal and toward this challenge. Please call us 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org and do your part so that we can say thanks to Julia Pendery and accept her $2,500 challenge.
Again, the number 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nancy Nersesian. She is professor of cognitive science at the Georgia Institute of Technology and author of a book called Creating Scientific Concepts. She's in town to speak tonight at UTD. Her lecture is entitled How Do Scientists Think? Creative Process in Conceptual Innovation. You can find information about that appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Nancy, what is bootstrapping?
Well, okay, so where the metaphor comes from is that old boots, you know, back in the olden days, used to have a strap on the back of them so that when you're putting your boots on, you would pull a strap to pull yourself up. Mm-hmm. So this metaphor was taken up by computer science, actually. When you talk about booting up the computer, okay, that's where the metaphor comes from. And so what it means is that trying to build the foundation or scaffold from which you can then continue to build and continue to build and continue to build until you get to the problem solution. So problem solutions don't come fully formed either. And problem solutions take a very long time, and often it's a very incremental process. But one piece builds upon another. And it's not, okay, also what I mean by bootstrapping, it's these more informal procedures like analogies and visualizations, you know, that I've been talking about in the book that help this booting process to create these sort of intermediary things until you can get to the problem solution. So it's not the same kind of reasoning that you would do if you do P then Q, P therefore Q. Mm-hmm. That's logical reasoning. And you wouldn't call that bootstrapping. But the idea of starting from some kind of analogy to then create a richer analogy to create a richer analogy until finally you figure out a way, oh, now I see the relationship between that and my problem. That would be an example.
How important is it as scientists are going through this process that they engage with other people and they get either criticism or input from people who might have a very different perspective on the same problem?
Yeah, it's vitally important. The idea of the isolated genius. It's
working
a myth.
In the garage or
Sorry.
Something. Yeah.
It's a myth because even the people who are doing that, there are people, you know, I mean, the Ramachandran in India and, you know, invented all this numerical theory when he wasn't part of any real community. But they are, even if they're just part of a community that reads and, you know, sees various critique. The point is that it's always in a social, cultural, material environment. And that supplies the kinds of information that you need. And in most cases, the critique and the feedback. Something doesn't become a scientific innovation until it's vetted by the community. So you can come up with all the creative things that you would like, but it doesn't count until the scientific community has vetted it. So, as you know, one of the examples I used in the book was, again, Maxwell. And, you know, Maxwell develops this field representation for electric and magnetic forces. And what that means is that there's continuous transmission of force. And this was a brand new idea in physics at that point, even though we're very much accustomed to it now. But until his community could take that and take that formalism and actually do experiments. For example, he predicted that the electromagnetic phenomena travel at the speed of light. Well, he was dead by the time they actually proved that. So it very much, you know, the value of it and the continual development really depends on the community. Yeah.
And it also points to the critical need of scientists to be able to communicate what they're doing. And we see a growing number of scientists here on this show who want to be able to communicate it to everyone and not simply people within the scientific community. Again, I want to go back to the education system. Are young scientists taught to really be able to explain and sort of evangelize what they're doing?
Well, again, I wish more. Okay, I don't think that there's a lot of that going on. They teach them like technical writing and things like that, but that's not getting at what you're talking about, sort of being really being able to articulate. So there is a movement within science education. So I'll talk a little bit about this program that we have at Georgia Tech, if that's okay.
Sure.
It's in biomedical engineering, and of course, because that's the areas we've been studying, and it's called problem-based learning. And what we do is we have classes that are designed with 8 students in it. When with 400 majors, that's pretty big investment on the university's part. Where the faculty have gotten together over a long period of time, we've developed and refined problems that we want them to work on. And part of this is to have the students work together in these groups trying to solve these problems with faculty acting as facilitators. So in the process of having to articulate how they did this, why they did it, what they chose, and being scaffolded by the faculty members as to, you know, in the direction that you want them to go in, we give them really wide open problems, problems that the engineers haven't solved either. But the point is so that they can learn to think and articulate what it is that they're doing so that then they're prepared when they go and take their regular lecture courses, which they need, they're prepared to think about it in a different way.
It must be a really different process when you're working on, say, either by yourself or with a team of one other person, as opposed to in a large group of people all trying to get at the same issue.
Yes and no. I mean, of course, when you're working by yourself, you're sitting and reflecting a lot, but of course, you're not getting that opportunity for critique or sparking ideas mm-hmm. from other sorts of people. One of the things this teaches them, actually, because many of them are going to be engineers, is to work in teams mm-hmm. because engineers often work in teams. So I think it's just it's somewhat different from working alone.
Yeah.
But from working with a group of 2 or working with a group of 8, I think it's just sort of a scale up. Mm-hmm. You get more input, you get more thoughts, more ideas. You have to learn how to manage and control the environment more.
So you talked about studying these 4 different labs. First of all, are each of them different in terms of sort of the social culture within the lab?
Yes and no. Okay. That is, one of the things that struck us about the first 2 labs that we did, that we thought they're entirely different subjects, and one is really benchtop work combined with engineering. So you see sterile hoods and all kinds of growing cells in the laboratory.
The lab we picture when we picture a lab.
The lab you picture when you picture a lab. But then the other lab is a lab that grows cultures of neurons, but that's sort of done in another room, the plating and all that stuff. And all you'd see is wires and incubator boxes, but you don't see any of the sense of the laboratory. It looks much more like a computer place. That contrast. And what you see is that a lot of the culture that develops is very similar. So we've called these agentive learning environments. That was our term that we came up with, because the students are made agents of their learning in there. And so they have various features. And I think these features go across all the labs, even though they're different. We've now just started studying a computational lab where everybody sits at computers. So some of the dynamics in there are going to be somewhat different,
yeah.
I'm sure, when we figure it out. But, for example, they're largely non-hierarchical. You think of a lab situation where the PI is the one who knows everything and comes in and, you know, tells everybody else what to do. Well, first of all, the PIs are hardly ever in these labs. You know, it's primarily the students who are running and doing the labs and research. And because they're on the cutting edge, nobody knows everything. And because they're interdisciplinary, people bring things from various areas. So there's a great leveling that takes place between, you know, the most advanced and the most junior people in there, because everybody has something to contribute.
Sort of a skunkworks model?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So everybody has something to contribute. And so there's rapid membership into the community because you kind of find where you can contribute. So that's another part of it. So it's non-hierarchical. It's rapid membership. There are support structures that evolve to support failure. Failure is ubiquitous. I'm amazed at how much these people fail and continue to work. But that's true. You know, see, this is the difference between looking at history of science, too. History of science, you don't see their failures. They don't record them very much. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at science live, you realize how persistent these people have to be because there's so much failure. But they evolve structures for supporting one another in failure. And that's another feature that these environments share. So I think there's a lot of commonality having to do with the nature of the process itself that develop and the kind of scaffolding that develops around helping people into the lab and become productive members.
Do scientists have to fight the same kind of confirmation bias that regular people do when they're seeking information about just about anything?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's actually been shown. And it's been shown also with respect to historical literature.
We're all humans after all.
Yeah, yeah. So a friend of mine, Ryan Tweeney, who's done a lot of work, psychologist, done a lot of work on Faraday. He, you know, has a paper in which he's shown Faraday's confirmation bias. Yes, they do. And that's why they have to constantly think that part of the scientific process, maybe not all of it, but a really important part of it, is what Karl Popper, the philosopher, said, falsification. So, it's not a simple naive thing. It's not a, you know, let's go out and show this wrong. But the point is to find the points where you may be overlooking something. I remember there's the story of how he told a Nobel Prize winner, Hayek, in economics. Hayek had discovered that his theory was wrong, and Popper said to him, "Well, okay, you're the one. Go refute it. Try to answer that." And then he won the Nobel Prize for that work.
I guess it really does take a certain kind of confidence, though, to get up every morning and go back into something that you were quite sure was correct.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the strategies that people use to deal with it. So we had one person, and actually some of the work I'm going to talk about tonight in the neuroscience lab, that she just had constant failure for almost a year. And at various points she said, you know, I'm leaving. You know, when this is done, if I do not, by end date, if I have not got a result, I'm leaving. Well, of course, she still didn't have a result at that point, but she hadn't left. We saw with the undergraduate students, one of them said, you know, sometimes I just have to go home and see my family, you know, right, and get the sustenance from their communities. So they develop strategies for dealing with it. But I think that's another important thing that we don't convey to students. We don't convey that persistence and hard work are really what you have to do in order to be successful in these fields, and that you are constantly going to be faced with this kind of failure. But if you just keep at it, you know, things in the long run, it looks like people do things. Not everybody is an Einstein, but people actually have productive careers in science, even if they fail 80% of the time.
Yeah, it seems like that's different in science, even in other disciplines, because the best and brightest are not expected to fail in other things they do.
Oh, yes. And to try to tell students that the objective of a lab, for example, when you're looking at, you know, making instructional labs, and we've done some work on that, that the objective of the lab is not for them to get the right answer, but for them to learn this process. Because, in fact, when they're doing very complicated things like Western blots and stuff like that, it's, you know, coming up with what might be a right answer is not the point. And the point is to try to learn these various methods. But they constantly, in their notebooks and in their responses to you, are saying, but, it, you know, what's right? I haven't got it right. Now, of course, we want them to learn what's right.
Right.
But the point is not all of their educational experiences should be geared towards that. But these are students who are primed with, I've been an all-A student and I've always got the right answer. Yeah.
Nancy Nersessian is my guest. She's professor of cognitive science at Georgia Institute of Technology. She's in town to give a lecture tonight at UTD as part of the ongoing Creativity in a Technological Era series. Her lecture is entitled, How Do Scientists Think? Creative Processes in Conceptual Innovation. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment. I am tongue-tied today. Right now, though, Jeff Whittington is back with us, and we are here to ask you to help us make this challenge grant by calling 1-888-694-6931 or going online and pledging at kera.org. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. The number is 1-888-694-6931. There is a $2,500 challenge grant on the table. We must receive 100 contributions by 2 o'clock in order to be able to accept this $2,500. It's a lot of money from Julia Pendry, and we've got to get 100 contributions at any amount by 2 o'clock. We've received a few. We still need 83 to go, Chris.
Whatever your contribution will be today, whether it's $50 or $5,000, consider that it is increased by $2,500. We're okay with you sort of taking that leap and saying, I got KERA to receive an extra $2,500.
That's right.
Because your contribution will be the thing. Just consider it the one that put us over the top.
You're all the 100th contributor.
Exactly.
Each, there are so many.
I hate to say
you...
this to the scientist in the room, but
there are so many of you listening, though, that if everyone, seriously, we say this all the time, and you probably don't believe it, but if everybody who is listening right now, if you would pick up the phone and call 888-694-6931, Not only would we make this challenge grant, it's likely that we would get pretty close to ending the whole membership campaign.
Yeah. How many people listen to this show in a typical hour?
You know, it depends. Our average quarter hour is usually in the 20 to 25,000 listener range.
So more than 100.
Yeah. More than 100 people listen to the show. And 400,000 people. I just saw some Arbitron rating trends for KERA, and it's 400,000 people a week listen to the station. But fewer than 40,000 people actually support the station, Chris. I mean, it's less than 1 in 10 listeners actually send money to the station. And so that's why it's so important that we thank those of you who do your part when you call 888-694-6931 or contribute online at kera.org.
Yes, very special thanks to Michelle Keel in Richardson, Charles Cuttigan in Allen, Sarah Hester in McKinney. Thanks also to Kelly Akins in Dallas, Annette Anderson in Arlington, and Sunjil Konda in Irving. We really appreciate your action today in on behalf of KERA, on behalf of public radio. It is a wonderful thing to be able to put a radio station together based on the needs and the desires of intelligent people as opposed to advertisers. Nothing wrong with the way commercial radio does things,
sure.
But it does cause their programmers to be beholden to the advertisers as opposed to the people who listen to the station.
Yeah, first of all, nobody ever sits around here and says, gee, we shouldn't do an hour on scientific concepts.
And what would Coca-Cola think?
Yeah, and how decisions get made in a scientific environment, you know, because someone may not support the station. I mean, this is the kind of conversation this show is all about. And Chris, I know that you're very interested in process and really what's going on behind somebody's eyeballs, what's going on in their mind. The show's called Think. I mean, it all works. And it works. And you support it when you call 888-694-6931. Make a new membership if you've never joined the station before. Rejoin the station if it's time for you to renew. Or if you are a current member, you can make an additional gift of $5 or $10 right now online at kera.org or at 888-694-6931. We've only got to get 100 contributions, just 100 contributions, and we can say thank you to Julia Pendery and accept an additional $2,500 for the station.
And be aware that as you make the call now, there are certain people that get really excited when we're down to the last 10 or 20, and then they'll call. So help us get to that quickly so that we will make that and not even have to worry or sweat whether or not we will be able to make this amazing challenge grant. We have we need to get 100 calls during the 2 hours today of Think. Right now we have 83 to go. We can certainly do better than that, and I'm sure there are calls coming in right now. Your contribution makes a huge difference right now in whatever amount. Again, the telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online and make a contribution there or check out some of the thank you gifts that we've had offered all week long. Most of them are still available. That address, of course, is kera.org. Again, the phone number, 888-694-6931. Back in just a minute to talk about how scientists think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Nancy J. Nersessian. She is professor of cognitive science at Georgia Institute of Technology. Her book is called Creating Scientific Concepts, and she's in town to lecture tonight at UTD. Her talk is entitled How Do Scientists Think? Creative Process in Conceptual Innovation. If you've got a question, you can join us now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk about whether this is the way, this sort of modeling approach, is this how science has been done since the Enlightenment?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should say more?
Say more.
Yes. Yes, actually it has. I mean, when you look back at the start, even before the Enlightenment period, I mean, if you look back at the start of the science in the Renaissance, Galileo is doing this kind of modeling. Newton is doing this kind of modeling. But I think, now this is sort of coming from a philosopher of science perspective, I think that the philosophy of science has actually created in its past a wrong view of science. a view of science that says that these kinds of things are not important. They're ancillary. They're off to the side. Because, you know, if you want to come up with the truth, then you have to use logic. Well, yes, there is logic that's involved in scientific verification and confirmation. But in scientific discovery, this is the kind of reasoning that's been used since then. So, for example, Galileo, when he was trying to look at the moon and argue that the moon was not a perfect body, that the stuff that we were seeing, the shadows, et cetera, they weren't just shadows, they were craters, that it was like, you know, earthly phenomena. Making a comparison between a heavenly body and earthly phenomena was a radical thing in those days because they were supposed to be two entirely different realms. Yeah. He looks at a stone fence and he says, see the wall? See how the light goes on the craters? The crater, that particular shadow, et cetera, that's what's going on up on the moon. So it's that kind of reasoning is there from its inception.
What's so interesting is that's such a simple model, if you think about mm-hmm. it. It seems beneath someone of Galileo's abilities.
Yes, but he did that constantly. So one of the things he had to argue for was the Copernican hypothesis, and that, you know, that the Earth is in motion and the Earth revolves around the sun. And people said, well, you know, I don't feel it. And if you think about it, you don't feel it. You don't feel the motion of the Earth. And he had to think about ways of arguing for relative motion. And so he used, again, very simple kinds of analogies and think about if you're in a ship and you're traveling from, you know, Venice to Aleppo and you're writing, okay, what path does your pen trace? What path does a ship trace? Well, you would say if the pen were drawing in the water, it would make the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But since it's sharing in the common motion with the ship, when you're just drawing on your little pad and that's all you see. So yes, constantly drawing on these kind of intuitive common sense notions, but to change common sense, because common sense is that we're not in motion.
We have an email here from Richard in Fort Worth who writes, I heard you say that laboratory classes, what they were to teach was that success in science comes from persistence and effort in the face of failure. And then it seems a perfectionist attitude would make that much more difficult. Have you researched and discussed the effects of perfectionist attitudes?
No, I haven't in particular, but I know people have. Mm-hmm. And absolutely. I mean, if we train our students to think that they need to be perfect, and we train our children from young, you know, ages that they have to be perfect in what they're doing in school, that's right. It's counterproductive. On the other hand, a little bit of perfectionism is okay. That is, that's also part of the thing that helps you to persist. So, okay, I got to get it right. It's not right yet. I got to get it right. But you have to realize I don't have to be perfect. I have to figure out how to get this to work or how to get to what I want to achieve.
So driven but pragmatic.
Right. Driven but pragmatic. Right.
Again, talking about your research in labs, is this kind of thinking best done in a traditional laboratory setting, or is it possible that a sort of more organic place to do work is good for this kind of thinking? I mean, organic may be the wrong word, but a setting outside of the laboratory itself.
Yes, well, the work goes on in both places, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you bring it with you.
Yeah.
So, for example, again, going back to Maxwell, who actually wasn't working in a laboratory, although he was in this environment in Cambridge where there was, you know, offices and a lot of stuff going on, a lot of talking. But he would often go to his country home in Scotland. And he'd be sitting there, you know, and well, actually I wrote one article and I started out with, you know, Maxwell on his porch in Scotland thinking whatever. Absolutely. I think we all need that. We do a lot of the thinking that we're doing in the environment that we're in, but then we need to retreat to some place where we feel, you know, we can kick off our shoes and think as well.
When scientists see your work, particularly your work in terms of how to train young scientists, do they automatically say, absolutely, I totally get that? Or is there sort of a leap for them to recognize that this sort of thinking has to be taught or should be taught?
I think at first, you know, it depends upon the communities. It's interesting. You're a little more immediately successful with engineers who are very practical. Mm-hmm. It's been a little harder in cases to bring scientists on board. But what has to happen in both cases is something that is very hard to do. What they do is tacit. It's become part of them second nature. So, for example, if you say to a scientist, and there have been expert novice studies of problem solving in science been done that confirm this up. But if you say to a scientist, here's a particular problem, you know, find an answer, help me find an answer. And if it's a something that the equation goes to immediately, of course they'll do it. But otherwise, they'll pull out the pen and they'll start sketching, or they'll start drawing what they call back of the envelope calculations. They just do that automatically. They don't think that that's something they should teach. Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant by earlier when I said that these kind of apprenticeships, you see your teacher doing that. And when you're a graduate student and you have access to that, and then you realize that that's the way to go. So what we've had to do also is to make the scientists realize this, the ones that we've been working with at Georgia Tech, and to introduce the language of model-based reasoning, which is, of course, not a way that we'd think about it, but then they would recognize it as soon as you start talking to them about it. Oh, yeah, that's it. And in this case, actually, I'm so happy with what we've been able to do in biomedical engineering because they've gotten on board wholeheartedly. And what they're trying to do now, independent of the research that I'm doing with my colleagues, is to develop, bring a bit of this into their own classes. And so they'll come to my colleague, Wendy Neustetter, who actually lives in the biomedical engineering building, and they'll come to her and they say, I'm thinking about how can I get this into this really advanced level course that I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. And she'll help them to do that.
An interesting bit of trivia about you is that you were also an opera singer. And I'm wondering what sort of thinking you've done about the relationship between these two for very different passions. At least most of us would see them as very different passions.
So I have to honestly tell you, not.
Really?
And the reason why not, I made it conscious, mm-hmm. okay? That is, I decided I can see very clearly, okay, particularly in pedagogy, mm-hmm. that many of the same kinds of things I'm talking about that I know that go on in science and that go on for my own science practice are very important to pedagogy in training a musician. But I decided I really wasn't going to think about it very deeply in a research sense until I stopped performing, because I think it would get in the way. So it would be like, I'm like one of those scientists, okay? We want them to think about that in a pedagogical situation, and I do when I've taught students voice, I've thought about it in a pedagogical situation. But you don't want to think about it when you're practicing it. So you don't want to think about, and now I will draw a diagram, and I don't want to think about, and now I will make the right kind of analogy so that my palate lifts.
Mm-hmm. So it has to feel automatic and joyful, I guess.
Yeah. Right, precisely. And so in order to keep it that way, I'm not researching it yet.
Fair enough. Nancy Nersessian is professor of cognitive science at Georgia Institute of Technology. Her book is called Creating Scientific Concepts. She's in town to speak tonight at 7:30 on the UTD campus as part of the ongoing Creativity in a Technological Era lecture series. Her talk is called How Do Scientists Think? Creative Process in Conceptual Innovation. Nancy, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, too. And I'm very happy that you joined me. I mean, that you joined me, right, that I was able to join you, that you invited me, and also that the Center has invited me, and I hope that people will come not only to my talk but to all the talks in this series, and they're planning a really great one next year of human enhancement through technology.
We could all use a little of that.
Yes, we could. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Nancy. Jeff Whittington is back with us now, and we are here to talk to you, update you on the progress of our challenge grant. We need to get 100 memberships or contributions, just 100 contributions during this hour, during the next hour, so that we will be able to get this wonderful challenge grant from Julia Pendery, $2,500 to KERA. You can make it possible. You can also make it not happen. You can be someone who sort of sits on your hands, even though you've thought about joining the station. It's entirely possible that it won't happen. Your contribution is really the difference between whether it does or it doesn't.
Yeah, just make the call, 888-694-6931. We must receive 100 contributions by 2 o'clock in order to say thanks to Julia Pendery and receive a $2,500 additional contribution to the station. It's really important that we make this one. Chris, we're making some progress. We've heard from a few people. We've heard from about 32 people during this first hour so far. We've got 68 left to go. I'd really like to not drag this out to the last minute. I'd like to just get this one
knock it out of the ballpark.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's win this challenge and accept the $2,500 additional gift. You know, because that's not the only reason to join. When you join right now, when you contribute right now, you're actually helping us end the drive, hopefully, by tomorrow.
That is a wonderful thing. We all are just as delighted as you are when the fundraising campaigns end. We're happy to get back full time to making the programming that we love to make and you love to listen to. But we wouldn't be able to make any of it without your support. Our telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. Just so you know, during this challenge grant, if there is a thank you gift that you're interested in, you can still receive that be part of the challenge grant. So if that's sort of holding you back and you really want to thank you gift, talk to the folks on the phone or check it out online and we can get that all squared away for you.
The number is 888-694-6931. Of course, the web address is kera.org. I want to say thanks to Stanley Stokes and Tyler, Riley Morris in Fort Worth, as well as Larry Trawick in Garland. Thank you so much for your call. We also heard from Betsy Lewis in Dallas. Thank you, Betsy Lewis in Dallas.
As we all often tell you, we're all members here, not because we have to be, but because we believe in it.
Joseph Duchesne in Irving, and is that
Sunny Scarborough
in Richland Hills, North Richland Hills, or maybe it's just Richland. Is there a Richland Hills? I guess there is. It looks like it.
Looks according to that piece of paper.
I've always heard North Richland Hills.
Well, if there's a North, then there must be a Richland Hills, right?
You'd think.
If there's a West Virginia, there's a Virginia.
Yes.
We spent the hour thinking with one of the foremost minds in this sort
in
of thing.
Thinking.
And then it's just us.
That's right. Sorry
so
now's
the perfect
that,
time
folks.
To call. You're not missing anything. You're not missing anything very educational in the next 3 to 5 minutes.
888-694-6931 is the number to call. Go online to kera.org. It really does just take a couple of minutes to fill out the membership form. I guarantee it because I did it myself not too long ago, and it just takes, you know, about 90 to 120 seconds. As long as you remember your name, your spouse's name, and your address and phone numbers, and you can fish out your credit card or you can click send me, you know, I want to do a personal check. That's all it takes. If you want to pick a thank you gift, it takes a little bit longer so you can take the time to look through and find the right thank you gift. And that's totally fine. Whatever it takes, people, to get you on the phone or to get you on the web at kera.org or the number 888-694-6931.
These contributions really add up fast. Whatever amount you want to give, you might do, you know, $20 a month. You might do $30 a month. You might do a day sponsorship, which is $365 a year. We can, I believe, split that up for you in a sustaining membership, or you can do it with a credit or a debit card, which is what we love because we are able to put the money to work right away. We are working again on this $2,500 challenge grant from Julia Pendery. We need 100 donations during the 2 hours of this show, so by 2 o'clock today. So far, we have 43 contributions. Have come in. We need 57 more. This puts us a little behind the halfway mark, which is a little behind where we would like to be right now. Your call to 1-888-694-6931 can make it possible. Thanks to Veronica Graves in Dallas, Michelle Garcia in Fort Worth, and Jason DePriest in North Richland Hills.
Okay. All right. So if you're in North Richland Hills, or maybe Richland Hills, give us a call. 888-694-6931. Or go online to kera.org. 57 contributions at any level to go to make this challenge. It's really crucial that we are able to accept this $2,500 challenge from Julia Pendery. It's a lot of money for a company that that really guards its purchases and its allocations of funds very carefully. And your call right now and a contribution at any level, or again, any level, if it's a $10 additional gift, that actually will, you know, tick one off the 100 contributions we have to have by 2 o'clock in order to get this challenge.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA Dallas-Fort Worth Denton, 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV Sherman.
And it's also always online, of course, at
kera.org.
And you can make a contribution there as well. And, you know, for those of you, I'm going to steal Chris's thunder here because she usually is the one that calls out the podcast listeners. But if you're listening to this on podcast and you're not fast-forwarding through the pledge break, then, you know,
why fast-forward when we might humiliate ourselves in
that's
some
right.
way?
Why haven't you called? That number still works, even if it's, you know, midnight in Chiang Mai, Thailand or something, or you're listening because you don't have to. And I'm not calling you out, Bill, in Chiang Mai, Thailand, because I know you supported the station in the past. But what I'm saying is no matter where it is, no matter what time it is, that phone number is going to work, 888-694-6931. It may not count toward the challenge that we've got this during the show today, but it will count toward this programming that you use, that you download, that you listen to from the Think podcast.
Yeah, we all come together to decide that public radio is important, and we're very lucky to be a big, vibrant station in a big, vibrant market. But the truth is, it only exists because people just like you listen to the call, actually believe us when we say we would like everyone who listens to make a contribution. Now, for some of you, $1,500 is no big deal. For others, maybe, you know, $10 or $20 is what you want to do. For most of you, I think the average contribution is somewhere about $120 or $130. The amount, though, that you want to do per year is entirely up to you, or per month if you do sustaining membership. We just ask that you call us now at 1-888-694-6931. Want to thank Frank Hall in Dallas and Jane Vincent in Plano, Rick Grunbaum in Dallas, and everyone else who is calling right now.
888-694-6931 is the telephone number. And yeah, we might have a station here, and we might all live and listen in a big, vibrant market, but we still have to raise the money one call at a time, one online contribution at a time. That's how it works. So please make your call right now. 888-694-6931 or contribute online at KERA.org. Again, working on a challenge from Julia Pendry. It's a $2,500 at-risk challenge. We must hear from 100 callers or online contributors with a donation at any amount by 2 o'clock. So please call 888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.